Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Football on off the ball.
Qualifying for World Cup was amazing. The birth of our child, Diego, was for me, it's the best feeling in the world. Nothing will ever top that. Like, but it was important that I came back and refocused and really tried to get this league over the line.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast
with UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
Dennis Walsh is with us. Dennis, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good, thanks.
We've been grappling with how to talk about this story a little bit all so far this morning, and I just... I think you could write it. Remember the OJ documentary that was like 8 parts about the history of America, essentially? I think you could do something similar with this. The first time I encountered DJ Carey was at a school afternoon. I must have been in primary school because me and my dad were going home for lunch. He was a primary school teacher, hurling obsessive. And there used to be colleges games scheduled for a tie in Geraldine Park because in the wintertime, the pitch was brilliant. Whatever happened there, whatever sand was in it, it meant that there was always good quality Leinster schools hurling matches. And this afternoon, instead of going back to school after lunch, we ducked into the GAA ground and there was a crowd there. I remember Tommy Brophy, who was also one of my dad's co-selectors in the senior team, had been to Kieran's. And Kieran's were playing, I can't remember who they were playing, but there was 3 future Kilkenny senior hurlers there: Adrian Ronan, Pat O'Neill, and the young small kid, DJ Carey. And we stood there that afternoon and we marvelled. And from that point on, I was totally hooked. We would go to Kilkenny a lot to club games. And I remember one time we were over in Hotel Kilkenny using their facilities and a kid came up to me and went, "I'm DJ Carey's cousin." And I was like, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, it was like from the moment that he was a teenager to right now, it's been a life lived in public. And you've managed to capture most of that in your piece today, which is a remarkable achievement in a couple of thousand words. So how are you processing all this?
Yeah, I mean, that college's campaign that you described there, Gerard, they beat my school actually in the All-Ireland semi-final. That Kieran's team with the 3 future Cork, Kilkenny seniors, and as you say, DJ being the wizard in the corner. And actually at the time, it's funny because even around that time, late 80s, and with that college's team, people thought that Adrian Ronan had a better chance of being the big star than DJ, funny enough. And he would have made a breakthrough with Kilkenny slightly earlier. Like, there was that famous picture of DJ and Adrian Ronan behind the school desk because they'd both been picked for a National League match or be on the panel for a National League match, and they were both still in St. Kieran's. And that picture was published in the Sunday Indo, a short piece by late Tom O'Riordan. And yeah, but like, can you imagine now, like, going into a school to photograph 2 young fellas who are going to be playing for Kilkenny at the weekend or the final, which just wouldn't happen. It's just not, you know, just it was, but even then it was completely out of the ordinary, you know. And yeah, it's extremely hard to process a job. Like, I started working in the Sunday Tribune in 1990, which was the year that DJ played his first championship match for Kilkenny. So I just happened to start writing with hurling at the time that he started and came through. So I would have interviewed him at regular intervals over the years, and he was always available, essentially, and always accessible. And so you kind of, I was looking over, I have some of the transcripts of the interviews, not just the pieces themselves, but the actual transcripts. And it was kind of 10,000, 12,000 word transcripts. And I was going over them last week, and you kind of look at them, you're reading them now with a completely different lens, because you're kind of wondering, like, how much was this, how much of this yarn are you telling me is true, and how much of it is fabrication, and how much of it is you know, a fib or a lie or whatever. And like, you were always conscious, even when you were interviewing, you were always conscious that he was always very anxious to manage the message. And you know, he was good at spinning, but it was kind of harmless too. You know, it was harmless, and it was completely harmless, like when you, in the context of his life turned, you know. But yeah, so it's extremely hard to process. Yeah.
Dennis, you say manage the message. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so like, there was always stuff that was swirling around DJ. So whether it was his relationship with money, how much was he getting paid to go here, there, or elsewhere, you know, like, he was, I mean, as his career progressed, DJ was very open about wanting to monetize his fame, and that the GA players should be allowed to monetize their fame. And he would have been a kind of a pioneer in that campaign, you know, which, like, a lot of stuff that we accept as normal now wasn't normal when DJ started. So players now turn up at product launches and all kinds of commercial gigs these days, and they're paid for their time, and rightly so. And but that wasn't common practice or normal practice 35 or 6 years ago when DJ started. So he was to the forefront of that push to break down those boundaries and to, well, push the boundaries, really. And so for the early years of his career, Cullum, he would have been fighting the perception that he, you know, was doing stuff for money left, right and centre, because that was seen as a negative, you know, that was seen as anti-amateurism, anti-GA, was against the, people would have seen it as being against the core values of the GA. So he kind of would have been denying stuff in the early part of his career, but then as his career went on, he flipped completely on that, like, and he would have been quite open about wanting to monetize stuff.
Yeah, because you used the word pioneer to in attribution to that time in his life when he wanted to monetize, and I suppose you could, because pioneer, there's a suggestion of respect there, positivity, because he was trying something that was, as you say, against the GA ethos. I imagine, Dennis, at the time that, generally speaking, there was a lot of backlash to that. Was there?
Yeah, kind of less and less as time went on. Like, so obviously the GPA came on the scene, and like, the GPA had a very difficult birth, you know, and so there was a lot of pushback against the GPA and the whole idea of a players' union, as would have been characterised. Like, there was a lot of pushback against that, but like, he was one of the founder members, and I mean, it wasn't just DJ, there were other players, other high-profile players who were pushing this as well. But nobody had a higher profile than DJ's, because he was the biggest superstar in the GA. And like, I mean, originally his image was very wholesome, you know, so he was this non-drinking, non-smoking, brilliant player who never put a foot out of place on the pitch. You know, he was the one that was put upon. He was the guy that was being blackguarded. You know, so his image was very clean at the start and for a long time afterwards. You know, so but he was one of a group of players that were pushing this, trying to change this mindset in the GA, but he was the most high profile of them.
Can you talk about the group he references, Knockers?
Yeah, so this was something that would come up in interviews with DJ on a regular basis. So he always seemed to have a sense of what people were saying about him, even though people would never say it to his face. But you know, whether he was, again, whether he was making this up or whether people were just, whether he was hearing it third hand, and like some of the stuff that he would say had a ring of, you know, it had a ring of truth about it. I mean,
yeah,
he definitely did have a consistency of Knockers, because not everybody wanted the GA to go in that direction, with, you know, players being able to make money from stuff on the side, if you like, commercial deals and so on. So, but yeah, it's gas now. As I said, looking back at transcripts last week from old interviews from 20 odd years ago, like, he would bring it up. I mean, it wouldn't be something that would be, it wouldn't have been included in a question. He would bring it up. So that was another kind of example of him wanting to manage the message. He wanted to get stuff out there. If he kind of had if you were his company for an hour or two, there was stuff that he would bring up that you just knew that he wanted to.
Yeah.
He wanted to.
Because in 2003, so he's spotted in Waterford Hospital, I think getting a scan on an injury. Someone spots him in the oncology department one thing leads to another and the rumour comes out that he's gravely ill, he has cancer. But it's as soon as 2005 that he starts that story. But then I think, you know, it's the defrauding probably occurs in the next decade. And I'm wondering, maybe this is a question of hindsight really, Dennis, but did you notice a change in DJ Carey yourself in dealing with him as the years went by?
I suppose the change that I described, we'll say from, I would have first interviewed him 1991 maybe. And I would have, the last time I interviewed him properly would have been the last year of his inter-county career. So that was 15 years later.
Yeah.
So the cancer story was interesting because that came up in an interview I did with him in 2003. I asked him about that. The rumour had been flying around about 18 months or 2 years previously. Now, this is before social media, and it was literally an old-fashioned rumour, word of mouth. So that was, and it was in the southern half of the country. Like, it wasn't a nationwide rumour. It was just very much contained to the southern, to I suppose the hurling counties maybe. But so that would have been 2001. So I asked him about it in 2003, and he would have used it as another example of a false story about me. So that was how he would have characterized it. So it wasn't, he didn't claim for a second that he was sick. I mean, he wasn't sick, and he didn't try to claim that he was. So that was a kind of a completely separate story to the one that kind of evolved later on. But it was just interesting that there was a rumor, you know, about that 25 years ago.
I do wonder if maybe he got the idea from it though. It's like, oh, you know, this rumor is out there. I can go back and revisit that. We don't quite know what the trigger for the cancer story was beyond him telling the guards when he gets arrested that he was in financial difficulties and he needed to stave off issues with the bank. But it turns out the bank actually reduced his 9.9 million debt to 60 grand, which seems very manageable considering he was raising 400 grand from people.
Yeah.
So there's still probably a few bits of this to fill in, are there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Emer Nebrenon's book is terrific. I read it over the weekend, and Emer has done an incredible amount of good old-fashioned journalistic digging. Like, she really put in the hard yards with that book, and it's a terrific read. And it's I think it answers a lot of that question that you asked there, Ger. I think people will find it extremely interesting. A lot of people spoke to her on the basis of anonymity, but that meant that they could speak more freely and more openly. And it's extremely, I mean, I think the court case already touched probably only touched the iceberg, or the tip of the iceberg of this story.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of other people who didn't feel comfortable about coming forward, but who were also victims in this case. So, but Emer's book is terrific. And
I know she's actually in studio with Owen tonight. So I'm sure they'll fill in some of those details as well.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early. Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
What was his standing as a hurler? Because I think Colin was asking the question earlier about, like, was he able to get away with all this because of sport? I don't want to paraphrase you, but like the importance of the sport prowess in helping him to grease the wheels of the fraud. So if you start writing about hurling in 1990, you kind of see a period where Kilkenny are good and then not great, But throughout all of that, like, his presence is kind of singular in many ways. It's difficult to compare him to anybody else.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, he was definitely the GA's first superstar. I mean, that's a hackneyed line, but it is the truth. And, like, he, as you said, Gerard Kilkenny weren't fantastic in the 90s. They won a couple of All-Irelands at the start of the decade, or they won All-Ireland in 92 and came back again later on and were very competitive towards the end of the 90s again. But so DJ was under pressure to deliver on a pretty ordinary Kilkenny team during that decade, and obviously a marked man all the time. Had incredible skill, obviously explosiveness, imagination on the pitch. And we'll say hurling has changed so much in the last 35 years, but it was a lot of it in the 90s was still traditional, what we would maybe call traditional hurling, or it was along kind of, some of it was along tram lines, and there wasn't much strategic thinking. And so a player like DJ would really have stood out in that environment, because of his skill set and because of his explosiveness and his capacity to do something extraordinary. He probably would not be quite as the way the game has changed and the way the game is played now would actually suit him perfectly, obviously. But there are a lot of brilliant players now. Because I think skill levels have gone through the roof in my time covering the game. But but DJ still had that status, and he still had that. One thing that haunted him throughout his playing career was his record in All-Ireland finals. And this was something that he kind of... DJ was the king of the humble brag. If you look back at interviews and... When he was criticised, or when he was addressing a criticism, he would answer the question in a way that made you under no illusions, or that gave you no illusions about how good he thought he was. And his record in All-Ireland finals was poor enough until 2002, when they beat Clare, and he was excellent in that final. In other finals, he'd been quite marginalised in the games or didn't contribute much from play, and he would have railed against that perception. That really bothered him. That, you know, it's gas when you think back now, there are things that bother people, but that bothered him at that period in his life. And because it kept on coming up, and people who wanted to knock DJ and would have brought up his record in All-Ireland finals. And it was kind of valid for the first three quarters of his career.
You touched on it there, Dennis. I actually just want to follow up on it again, is because labelling him as like GAA's first superstar is such a huge acclaim and accurate for so many people, because every era of both Gaelic football and hurling would be festooned with skillful players, and sometimes generational, that you've never seen before. And you mentioned his record in finals. He won 5 All-Irelands, but there have been others, you know, overall, who've maybe done more and more consistently, or whatever it is. So why was he the first superstar? Are we talking about the person being charismatic, charming? Is there something that went with the hurling that we basically cared so much?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of things, Colm. I think it was a kind of a media. I think the coverage of Gaelic games really exploded in the 90s. There was more newspapers than, you know, the English newspapers came in, the English titles came into Ireland, and like, there was a lot of newspapers bought in the 90s. That's hard to believe now. The Hurling Championship took off, you know, the Guinness sponsorship, and some more live TV, and the back door came in, so there was more matches. It was kind of it was a fertile ground for that kind of language, you know, and that kind of, for that kind of player to exist. So, I mean, Christy Ring was a superstar, but the word superstar, that notion didn't exist. You know, it was like, superstar was kind of a modern, that word and the hinterland around that word was kind of a modern, and it was a media creation. And so he just came along at a time when that stuff was going on. Like, I mean, the Premier League took off in the 90s, and there were superstars all over the place, inverted commas. And so, like, he was our kind of superstar. He was our Premier, like, and if you look back at some of the pieces people would use, or they would make comparisons between DJ and the Premier and a Premier League footballer. Yeah. Like, it was just part of it. It had come into the idiom. It wasn't just his, because he wasn't, when he was charismatic, Colm, in terms of how he played and in terms of how he was able to handle himself in public and how he was in front of a microphone. And he kind of had this wholesome altar boy image almost. And that appealed to a certain constituency, you know, and kids loved him for the way he played. You know, he was electric. He really was. And so there was all those factors. So, like, you know, Jason Sherlock came along then later in the 90s, and he kind of had a similar impact for a while in football. You know, he was different. He was creative and explosive and scored goals. I mean, that was a big thing with DJ, scoring goals. Like, hurling compared to now was much more low scoring. Much more low scoring. A goal in the hurling game was huge. Like, and a DJ Carey goal felt like it was worth 4 points because of what it did for Kilkenny, what it did for their crowd, what it did to the opposition. You know, we had a plan for DJ and he's after scoring a goal. So, like, all those things kind of, there was an aggregation of all those things.
You're right to almost remind us there that other sports would use Kilkenny and DJ Carey, because any time Eamon Dunphy went on an existential rant about the state of the game on RT with the panel, inevitably he would talk about the great Kilkenny side and DJ Carey would be mentioned. Yeah. So with all that said and his greatness as a player, this is a difficult question for anyone to answer, but maybe you're better placed than most. What happened to him?
I think, well, we're all here now as amateur psychologists. I think some of the personality traits that were evident in his career were, when you think about it, were the things that were, you know, contributed to his downfall. So he did have an obsession with money. I mean, that's clear. I mean, it was one of the things that was thrown at him all through his playing career. And in the end, he kind of, you know, he never would have said that. I mean, he would have denied having an obsession with money. But it was clear that he was the most determined of all the players to monetize his profile and to make money wherever he could. On that journey, and he ended up with a really lavish lifestyle for a variety of reasons. You know, I interviewed him in his house in Monkstown. I spent an afternoon with him in his house in Monkstown that he shared with Sarah Newman when I was researching my book, and that was a beautiful house, an absolutely beautiful house, and they had other properties at that time. So, like,
a chalet, obviously, in Switzerland. There was K Club and Mount Juliet houses. Yeah. And some of those end up being on the deal with the bank that ends up getting written down.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it was a classic Celtic Tiger tragedy in that sense. I mean, there was a lot, it was hundreds of thousands of people suffering the Celtic Tiger, but people who were in over their heads to the extent that they were really suffered. So, I never thought he was narcissistic, but maybe he was, you know, maybe there was an element to that. Again, like, who are we to say? We don't have the, I'm sure DJ has been assessed in recent months and last couple of years since this case started, assessed by health professionals and so on. But but certainly that obsession with money, Cullum, I think that trait, that characteristic, it was there in his hurling career and it spilled over spectacularly into his post-hurling career and, you know, certainly contributed to where he is now.
Some people were paid back. I mean, is that covering your tracks? I mean, these are obviously all questions we can't answer, but Eimear Nivrenon, and I haven't read the book yet, but she's done a podcast and she'll be on with Owen, as Ger said, tonight. So I've heard Eimear talk about the contents of her book. And one story she says is that he was playing golf with some buddies, DJ, and afterwards he was lamenting the fact that he didn't have enough money to throw his son his 21st birthday party. So between them, they gave him an amount, which I think went to about €800. And he paid them back. Dennis, there was no problem. He did that. But then you'll have the Dennis O'Brien amount of money, Tommy Butler amount of money.
Yeah.
And it was systematic. It was business-like.
And I mean, I think, I mean, 400,000 roughly is the figure that would come out in court. But I mean, I doubt that's the end. I mean, that's not the end. I mean, I'm sure that's not the end.
There's loads of people who didn't come.
I can't imagine that's the end. That's the end of it, you know. So, so it's because, I mean, it was over such a long period of time. I didn't I didn't cover DJ during that period of his life. He was kind of, he was off the grid from our point of view. He never kind of got in. I mean, he would have had a newspaper column, during his career while he was playing and for a while afterwards. He would have been tried on the Sunday game and never didn't work out as a pundit on the Sunday game. So he kind of drifted a bit to the margins, like, apart from the society pages, with Sarah Newman and stuff that they were doing. And golf, golf became a big thing in his life, really.
Yeah, because he's a fabulous golfer by all accounts. But he had DJ Carey Enterprises, right, was his own business because he wanted to be a businessman. So he had this business and he was employing, I think, more and more people, friends and family, sister and parents and all that. But then by the end, or maybe the latter few years, he didn't have a job. Is that right? Or he certainly went between jobs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, he'd no visible means of income in the last 2 years. And he would have had a gig with Carlo IT for a while, yeah. which actually isn't that long ago at all. I mean, DJ was like a Kenny senior selector during COVID. I mean, I remember being in Croke Park during one of those, deserted Croke Park matches where he was over on the far side with the Hurleys and Brian Cody and was on the near side. He was over in front of the Celtic stand. So, like, he was... He'd done the Kilkenny under 21s at that stage. He'd been involved with Carlo IT in the Fitzgibbon Cup. So he still had standing, absolutely had standing in the game and had standing in Kilkenny. I mean, that's what, 4 or 5 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, DJ Carey Enterprises, he started up, he started that column very young, like in his early 20s. That business got into trouble in the late 90s. He would have leaned on people, good people in Kilkenny GA, actually, who straightened that business out as much as they could. There was strong remedial work went in there, but like DJ Carey Enterprises as a business, I mean, I think at one stage he was employing 15 people, but no more than that. And 15 people was kind of too many. He had outgrown. The business had outgrown its viability, even with 15 employees at that stage. No, that was back in the 90s.
That's kind of a final question for me is, how do we talk about him now and his legacy? I mean, is it kind of today and tomorrow and then he disappears?
Yeah. I wonder. I mean, yeah. There's going to be Kilkenny Silver Jubilee teams in Croke Park for the next number of years,
yeah,
where there'll be a gap, up in the forward line, and his name will be called out in Croke Park, I'm sure. And I don't know whether his son is going to stand there or whether Noma's going to stand there. Or, I mean, they had that issue this year, obviously. So that's going to come up before he's a free man again. Whether stuff, Lord knows, Colm, it's hard to imagine people referring to stuff he did in a compartmentalized way. Can you really compartmentalize his hurling career from what happened afterwards and just talk about his hurling career as if nothing else ever happened? I don't think you can.
I don't know. I wonder, is there any way back from a situation like this? Obviously, in the immediate aftermath of the stories coming out, and for the next few weeks as the stories will come out from people, it always seems like there's no way back, but I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a piece he wrote in 2013 in The Independent. I don't know what day of the week, so I don't know if it was a Sunday or it was a Saturday, sorry, where he's talking about the morning of the 2003 All-Ireland Final, where his divorce or his separation from his wife at that point is splashed in the papers. And he talks then about how his ex-wife had been a big help to him when he was sick last year. And I think there was an illness around, there was the myocarditis at that stage in 2012. And
yeah,
it seems like that was the point where he's like, oh, I can get a lot of sympathy for this.
Yeah, it's funny because the marriage breakup story was another example of DJ's otherness. Like, no other GA player's marriage breakup had ever been covered in the papers. It was nobody's business. I mean, that was the stuff of Premier League football and other professional sports. So that story, crikey, that was a horrible week. That story broke on the Thursday, one of the tabloids went with it at the time. And for a few days, there was all this talk that there was going to be more stuff in the Sunday papers on the morning of the match. And DJ was captain of Kilkenny that year. They were playing Cork in the final. And Eamon Dunphy's new chat show started on the Friday night on TV3, as it was then. And Liam Griffin and Gerard Nan were two of his first guests. And Eamon did a kind of a monologue before they came on at the start of his show, pleading with papers not to publish whatever they were going to publish about DJ, not knowing what they had or what they didn't have. And there were solicitor's letters sent by DJ to a couple of papers around town. The Sunday Indo's editorial on the Sunday, sorry, the Sunday World's editorial on the Sunday was about a solicitor's letter that DJ had sent them, and they had a rag out of the letter, which they published. And so there was this kind of, I mean, when you look back, Katrina, his sister, was quoted in one of the papers. Like, she answered the phone to somebody and she said, look, it's just a marriage breakup. It happens all the time. And it's sad and all the rest of it. But, you know, but there was this circus for 3 or 4 days around that story. And nobody had anything else to say on Sunday. Like, there was nothing else to add on the Sunday. Sunday Indo gave it huge coverage. I remember going back to the archives a couple of years ago and looking at what all the papers did that weekend. And it was just another example of why DJ was different.
Like, it's obviously not cause and effect, but there must be some impact of going through that. Like, I'm not blaming the papers for what he subsequently becomes, but when, I don't know, you know, there's a toll to be paid when we treat people like this.
Sure. And like, and it's funny because like his relationship with Sarah Newman became public, you know, months later or within a year. I mean, he went off with Sarah on an RTE travel program. They were kind of the guest, you know, these guest hosts or whatever. They went to South Africa and they were the front page story on the RTE guide. So it all settled down from that point of view relatively quickly afterwards. But like, it was just, as I said, it was the very fact that anybody in the media felt that it was fair game to pry into the marriage of Gia Pair. A line was crossed there. Absolutely, a line was crossed there. And I don't think any other GA player has experienced that since. I'd be 100% sure that I can't remember any other GA player who had to experience that before or since.
Dennis, great stuff today. Thanks a million for joining us.
You're welcome.